Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks by the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, a special edition of the Archive Project in which excerpts from the Book of Unknown Americans by Christina Henriquez are performed by actors from the Milagro Theater. The lineup of performers include Danelle Milan, Ajay Terezes Tripathi, Monica Domena, Giovanni Alva, and Shanika Tiez. The Book of Unknown Americans explores the lives of two families who have come to the United States from Mexico and Panama, as well as the experience of men and women who have immigrated from all over Latin America to pursue different versions of the American dream. It was chosen as a New York Times Notable Book of 2014, one of the Washington Post Top 50 Fiction Books, and an NPR Great Read, among other accolades. Everybody Reads is a community reading project of the Multnomah County Library, made possible in part by gifts to the Library Foundation. The Everybody Reads program celebrates the power of books in creating a stronger community through a shared reading experience. In partnership with the Multnomah County Library and the Library Foundation, Literary Arts is proud to present Christina Henriquez at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as the culminating event of the 2014 Annual Community Reading Project on Tuesday, March 8, 2016 at 7:30 p.m. Founded in 1985, the mission of the Miracle Theater Group, a.k.a. the Milagro, is to provide extraordinary Latino theater, culture, and arts education experience for the enrichment of all communities. Learn more about the Milagro at milagro.org. Here are selections from the Book of Unknown Americans by Christina Henriquez. It's the Multnomah County Library's 2016 Everybody Reads book, performed by actors from the Milagro Theater.
Hello. I'm Danelle Milan, founding director of Teatro Milagro, and I would like to welcome you to this presentation, made possible by Multnomah County Library, of excerpts from Christina Henriquez's new novel, The Book of Unknown Americans, the 2016 Everybody Reads selection. The book follows the story of Arturo and Alma Rivera, who migrate to the U.S. from the small town of Pátzcuaro, Michoacán, in hopes of better medical care for their daughter, Maribel. They land in a small apartment complex in Delaware, where they befriend the many other immigrants who also settled there. The novel is set in the early 2000s, at a time of fewer travel restrictions. But many of the same biases and discriminatory practices face many immigrants arriving today, making the unknown Americans continually relevant. Hopefully, without any plot spoilers, we'll bring to life for you some of the many illustrious characters that populate the apartment complex, sharing their stories, hopes, and dreams, beginning with the wife of Arturo and mother of Maribel, Alma Rivera.
Back then, all we wanted was the simplest things: to eat good food, to sleep at night, to smile, to laugh, to be well. We felt it was our right as much as it was anyone's to have those things. Of course, when I think about it now, I see that I was naive. I was blinded by the swell of hope and the promise of possibility. I assumed that everything that would go wrong in our lives already had. 30 hours after crossing the border, we arrived, the three of us in the back seat of a red pickup truck that smelled of cigarette smoke and gasoline. "Wake up," I whispered, nudging Maribel as the driver turned into a parking lot. "We're here, hija."
"Where?"
"Delaware." She blinked at me in the dark. Arturo was sitting on the other side of us.
"Is she okay?"
"Don't worry," I said. "She's fine." It was just after sunset, and darkness bled in from the outer reaches of the sky. A few minutes earlier, we'd been on a busy road, driving through four-way intersections past strip malls and fast food restaurants. But as we neared the apartment building, all of that had given way. The last thing I saw before we turned onto the long gravel lane that led to the parking lot was an abandoned auto body shop, its hand-painted sign on the ground, propped up against the gray stucco facade. The driver parked the truck and lit another cigarette. He'd been smoking the whole trip. He gave him something to do with his mouth, I guess, since he'd made it clear from the moment he picked us up in Laredo that he wasn't interested in conversation. Arturo climbed out first, straightened his cowboy hat, and surveyed the building. Two stories made of cinder blocks and cement, an outdoor walkway that ran the length of the second floor with metal staircases at either end, pieces of broken styrofoam in the grass, a chain-link fence along the perimeter of the lot, cracks in the asphalt. I'd expected it to be nicer. Something with white shutters and red bricks. Something with manicured shrubs and flower boxes in the windows. The way American houses looked in movies. This was the only option Arturo's new job had given us, though, and I told myself we were lucky to have it. Silently, in the dim and unfamiliar air, we unloaded our things. Plastic trash bags packed with clothes and sheets and towels. Cardboard boxes filled with dishes wrapped in newspaper. A cooler crammed with bars of soap, bottles of water, cooking oil, and shampoo. During the drive, we had passed a television set on the curb, and when he saw it, the driver braked hard and backed up.
You want it?
Arturo and I looked at each other in confusion.
The television?
You want it? Take it.
Arturo said,
Isn't that stealing?
The driver snorted.
People throw everything in the United States, even things that are still perfectly good.
Later, when he stopped again and pointed to a discarded kitchen table, and later again at a mattress propped up like a sliding board against someone's mailbox, we understood what to do and loaded them into the truck. After we carried everything up the rusted metal staircase to our apartment, after we found the key the landlord had left for us, taped to the threshold of the door, Arturo went back down to pay the driver. He gave him half the money we had. Gone. Just like that. The driver put the bills in his pocket and flicked his cigarette out the window.
Good luck,
I heard him say before he drove off.
After the Riveras get settled in their apartment, they begin to make friends with the other tenants. Many share their trials and tribulations of how they came to live there. No exception is the story that illustrates the title of the book, The Journey of Micho Alvarez.
I came from Mexico, but there's a lot of people here who, when they heard that, they think I crawled out of hell. They hear Mexico and they think, bad, devil, I don't know. They got some crazy idea. Any of them ever been to Mexico? And if they say, yeah, I went to Acapulco back in the day, or I've been to Cancun, papi, then that shit don't count. You went to a resort, congratulations, but you didn't go to Mexico. And that's the problem, you know? These people are listening to the media, and the media, let me tell you, has some f***ed up ideas about us, about all the brown-skinned people, but especially about the Mexicans. You listen to the media, you'll learn that we're all gangbangers, we're all drug dealers, we're tossing bodies in the vats of acid, we want to destroy America, we still think Texas belongs to us, we all have swine flu, we carry machine guns under our coats, we don't pay any taxes, we're lazy, we're stupid, we're all wetbacks who cross the border illegally. I swear to God, I'm so tired of being called a spick, a nethead, a cholo, all this stuff. Happens to me all the time. I walk into a store and the employee either ignores me or they're hovering over every move I make because they think that I'm gonna steal something. I understand, I might not look like much. I work as a photographer, so I'm not in a business suit or nothing, but I have enough money to be in any store. And even if I didn't, I have the right to be in any store. I feel like telling them something. You don't know me, man. I'm a citizen here. I shouldn't have to tell anyone that. I want to be given the benefit of the doubt. When I walk down the street, I don't want people to look at me and see a criminal or something that they can spit on or beat up. I want them to see a guy who has just as much right to be here as they do, or a guy who works hard, or a guy who loves his family, or a guy who's just trying to do the right thing. I was just one of these people, just one, would actually talk to me, talk to my friends, man. And yes, you can talk to us in English. I know English better than you do, I bet. But none of them even want to try. We're the unknown Americans, the ones no one wants to even know, because they've been told they're supposed to be scared of us, and because maybe if they did take the time to get to know us, they might realize that we're not the bad. Maybe even that we're a lot alike them. And who would they hate then? The whole thing is very, very complicating. I mean, does anyone ever talk about why people are crossing? I can promise you, it's not with some great ambition to come here and ruin everything for the gringos. People are desperate, man. We're talking about people who can't even get a toilet that works,
And the government is so corrupt that when they have the money, instead of sharing it, instead of using it in ways that would help their own citizens, they hold on to it and encourage people to go north instead. What choice do people have in the face of that? Like, they really want to be tied to the underside of a car or stuffed into a truck like a rug or walking nothing but some sorry-ass sandals through the burning sand for days, a bottle of hot water in their hand? Half of them end up dead or burned up so bad that when someone finds them, their skin is black and their lips are cracked open. Another half of them drown in rivers. And half after that, picked up by La Migra and sent back to where they came from, or beaten or arrested. And for what? To come here and make beds in hotels along the highway? To be separated from their families? And then, there are a lot of us who come here because they actually want to try to do something good in this country. In my case, I was working in a newspaper in Sinaloa for years, trying to report on the drug war, trying to make people there aware of what's happening in their own backyard, but my bosses only had an appetite for the macabre. They kept sending me out to take photos of crime scenes that they'd plaster on the front pages. I did it first because I thought, you know, that's what people need to see. Maybe people would be shocked into action. But after a while, I realized that it was all just spectacle. Photos of decapitated bodies weren't helping anyone. So I wanted to come to the other side, across the border. No one here wants to admit it, but the United States is part of Mexico's problem. The United States is feeding the beast, man. I thought maybe if I came here, I could make a difference. I work with a group in Wilmington that's advocating for legislation reform for immigration. I do all the photography for their newsletters and their website, pictures of people living conditions or of some bodily harm that they've suffered because they got jumped for just being brown in this country. I don't know. We don't make much progress most of the time. But what else am I gonna do? I gotta fight for what I believe in, right?
While many of the characters in the book struggle to find success, Christina's book also highlights the small triumphs that some of the characters find in the quest for the American dream, such as the story of Adolfo Fito Angelino.
I came here in 1972 because I wanted to be a boxer like the great Juan Carlos Jimenez, who was from Paraguay, like me. There was a trainer in Washington, D.C., who was good, who was very good, legendary, who specialized in flyweight fighters, which is what I was, skinny but strong. I wrote the trainer a letter, Sully Samuelson, what a name. And he wrote me back, a letter signed with his name. He told me he wasn't taking on new fighters, but that if I was ever in D.C., I should look him up. Maybe he assumed that because I was all the way over in Paraguay, the chances weren't good I would ever be in D.C. Maybe it was just a bluff, is what I'm saying. But I thought, if I could just get a meeting with him, if I could show him what I was capable of, that I was going to be the next Jimenez, there was no way he wouldn't want to work with me. So I went to his gym, and every day I bounced around, pow, 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 light as air on my feet, and then boom! A hook you never saw coming. I wore red satin shorts and the best pair of boxing shoes I could afford. I was waiting for Sully to take notice, to see me, and recognize that I was a champion. But after a few days, nothing. And when I finally asked one of the guys about him, I found out that Sully had moved to Vermont, which was a place I never even heard of. Vermont? What is that? I thought I would go, Vermont! But I only made it as far as Delaware. I ran out of money on the way, so I got off here and found a job laying blacktop for a few days, trying to earn enough for another bus ticket. It was supposed to be temporary, but I was seal coating the parking lot of this building, and the landlord, he used to stand out on the balcony, smoking a cigar while I worked. Name was Oscar. Turned out, he was heading back to Montevideo, where he was from. And the guy who owned the building back then wanted him to find a replacement to manage the property. For some reason, he thought I could do the job. No way, I told him. I'm gonna be a boxer. He took one look at me and laughed.
You?
I challenged him to an arm wrestling match. I said if I beat him, he had to give me the money for the ticket to Vermont. But if he beat me, I'd take the building manager job instead. Well, here I am. No shame in it. Who comes to the United States and ends up in Delaware? I, for one, never thought I'd be here. But I've been surprised. It's popular with the Latinos. And all because of the mushroom farms over in Pennsylvania. Half the mushrooms in the country are grown here. Back in the 70s, they used to hire Puerto Ricans to harvest everything. But now it's the Mexicans. And they used to set up the workers with housing, too. Shit housing, with rats as big as rabbits. Boarded up windows, no hot water. After Reagan's amnesty deal, workers started bringing their families up from Mexico. They didn't put their wives and children up in that housing, though. They found other places to live. Places like Delaware. It's cheaper than Pennsylvania. And no sales tax. We have all the Spanish supermarkets now, and the school district started those English programs. I know some people here think we're trying to take over, but we just want to be part of it. We want to have our stake. This is our home too. I like it here. I started off as a manager, but now I own this building. I bought it out almost 10 years ago after working jobs on the side, saving up. It's a good deal. The area is changing, though. A clash of cultures. I try to make this building like an island for all us washed ashore refugees. A safe harbor. I don't let anyone mess with me. If people want to tell me to go home, I turn to them and smile politely and say, I'm already here.
Alma Rivera was not that impressed with the dingy little apartment building that Adolfo owned. And she struggled to make it feel more like a home. She would head out to the market to buy food with a little bit of money Arturo brought home from the mushroom farm, and try to navigate the bus system with no English-speaking skills. One of the first neighbors to reach out a helping hand to her was Quisqueya Solis.
Where should I begin? Venezuela is where I was born and where I lived until I was 12 years old. I was a very beautiful child, happy in every way. But when I was 12, my mother fell in love with a man from California. He asked her to marry him, so we moved to his home in Long Beach. It was an enormous house with a pool in the courtyard. I believe a famous architect had designed it. Hollywood studios called us sometimes to see about using the house in a movie or for a commercial shoot. It was very glamorous. I was content there for a while. My mother's new husband had a son, Scott, from a previous marriage who was 2 years older than me. Scott paid no attention to me in the beginning. But soon enough, as my body began to change and I grew into womanhood, he took another look. He was always walking in on me in the shower, claiming he didn't know I was in there, or I would catch him watching me while I tanned by the pool. I tried to ignore him when I could. I kept the door to my room locked. Scott and I were at the house one night. I was 16. It was a rainy evening. My mother and his father were out at dinner. I was in the kitchen getting a soda from the refrigerator when he came up from behind and kissed me. I remember very clearly he said,
"It's okay, we're not really brother and sister, so it's fine."
But it wasn't fine with me. I tried to push him off, but he was stronger than me. I wasn't a prude, I had kissed boys before, but this was not what I wanted. He came at me again. He knocked me to the floor and climbed on top of me. He did unspeakable things, all against my will. I don't know why, but he thought he could do whatever he wanted. That's how boys are. Later, I told my mother what he had done to me, but she didn't believe it. She accused me of trying to ruin things for her.
Look at this life they've given us.
She warned me not to be ungrateful. Of course, I was only more upset after that, and I felt I couldn't stay there in such proximity to Scott. I knew it was only a matter of time before he came for me again. I told my mother I was moving out. She didn't fight it. She didn't offer to go with me. I don't think she had ever even wanted a child. She had me as a result of a one-night stand. I was less important than the things she had now. A nice house and diamond jewelry, an expensive car and a big refrigerator. It was the life she had always dreamed of. We were even citizens now, and in the United States, no less. I went to a shelter and told them that I was on my own. I lied and said that my parents were both dead and that I had been fending for myself. I stayed with a girlfriend for a little while, too. I lived in her pool house for months, and her parents never even knew I was there. I missed my mother, but the truth was that I had missed her even when we were together, so it was nothing new. As soon as I got my high school diploma, I left California. The girlfriend I had stayed with was going to go to college in New Jersey. Her parents had given her a car for graduation, so she was going to fill it with her belongings and drive across the country to her new school. She offered to take me with her. I stayed with her in her dorm for a while until I found a job waiting tables and saved enough money to live on my own. I met a certain man while I had that job. He used to sit at the counter and order blueberry pie. He used to flirt with me sometimes. I tried to resist him. I was suspicious of men by then. I wanted nothing to do with them, but he was persistent and he was kind and he made me laugh. He started staying after the restaurant had closed, talking to me while I cleaned up. He used to walk me home when it was dark. He didn't know what he was getting into with me, though. He never did anything wrong, but it was a struggle for me to truly be close to him. It was difficult because of my past to trust him. I pushed him away every time he came back to me. I pushed again until finally he left. But he's the father of my two boys, and I've gone out of my way to make sure that they turn out to be good and respectful. When they were in my house, they never laid a hand on a girl. Never a kiss, nothing. I was very watchful. It's possible they're the only good boys in the world. With the help of scholarships and financial aid, they're able to attend university. They're studying hard there. Now I receive money every month as part of my divorce settlement. So financially I'm secure, but I also choose to volunteer my time on Mondays and Wednesdays at the hospital because I feel I should do something positive with my time, something to help people. It's the least I can do. I have enough money that maybe I could live somewhere else, but my friends are here. Besides my boys, my friends are all I have. Almost no one in my life knows what I've been through, nor do I want them to know. Something should be private, that's what I always say. Besides, I don't need anyone's pity. My life has been what it has been. It's not a wonderful story, but it's mine.
Not all of the tenants in the building had such an easy road to Delaware, as we learn in the story of Benny Quinto.
My name is Benny Quinto. I came from Nicaragua, baby, the land of lakes and volcanoes. Been here 8 years, almost to the day. Back in Nicaragua, I was studying to be in the priesthood. I thought I heard God calling my name from up in the clouds somewhere, man. And I thought he was telling me I was the chosen one. This deep, booming voice. I wasn't even high. Drugs hadn't even come into my life yet. But I think I must have been hallucinating or something because I've had conversations with God since then. And he's like, nope, I don't know what you're talking about, Benny. Never said all about you being the one. Sorry to disappoint. A few buddies of mine left Nicaragua to come make some real bones over here. Wasn't no money for pinoleros like us back in home. Politically, you know, it wasn't so bad anymore. Somoza was long gone. The Contras were nothing but a memory. But leaving the poverty of Nicaragua to go to the richest country in the world didn't take much convincing. I left when I was 20. Told a dude I would pay him $2,000 to bring me over, $300 up front. Took me a while to scrape it together, $300. Nicaragua? You could live off of that for a while. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I stole some of it from the church. Stuffed the offering envelopes up under my shirt 1 week when I was supposed to be doing my Eucharistic ministry duties and walked out with it. I was gonna do whatever it took. I'm like that. I get something in my head and it's like some kind of block. No way to get around it. I just have it bulldozed through. I got shunted into this house in Arizona until I could pay the rest of the money. I mean, they told us we were in Arizona. It was me and 12 other guys, but we could have been in Russia for all we knew. We could have still been in Mexico, which is where we had to come up through to get over. It's like a funnel. Would have been nice if Nicaragua bordered with the U.S., but it doesn't. So up through Mexico I went. That house in Arizona, that place was intense. I didn't see the sun for, like, weeks. And Arizona is one of those places that might as well be on the sun. That's how sunny it is. So it's nuts that we never saw it. The blinds were shut and There were heavy bed springs all over the windows, and me and those guys, we were like cockroaches crawling over each other all hours of the day. There was no room to move. Just sit tight, keep the faith. I don't even know why we had to pay so much money. I mean, it wasn't no Ritz-Carlton. Wasn't even no Ritz Cracker Box. But that's the thing. It's just extortion, top to bottom. I wanted to get the hell out of there, so I called an uncle I used to be close with. I mean, he used to come to my birthday parties when I was a kid, and he would take me to the beach sometimes and let me play in the water while he smoked and hit on girls. But he didn't have the funds. I didn't even bother to ask my mom and pop. Those two never have nothing. You know how the gringos say it.
No dinero, muchacho.
If that weren't the truth, I never would have left Nicaragua to begin with. One of the guys in the house started dealing for the smugglers. He earned out his fee in 2 weeks. I didn't know how else I was gonna get out of there, so I signed up too. Figured I'd burn through it, you know, just get it done. Until I had enough to leave and then I'd be on the bigger and better things. Problem is, you get a taste of that kind of money, and it's so hard to go back to anything else. I was on the streets in Phoenix. We had certain places we always hit up. White kids who wanted to score came with their parents' money rolled up in their fist, acting all sly as they handed it over, thinking they were so street. But the truth was, you could name your price with those kids. Whatever you told them, they would pay. They didn't know any better, most of them. There were some real junkies who came by too, some pretty hard dudes. I got tangled up with a few of them once, just a stupid fight. And the next thing I knew, I woke up one morning, busted out of my mind, bleeding out of my side. I'd been stabbed and didn't even know it. That's when I decided how to end. I hitched a ride out of Arizona with the guy who was driving to Baltimore. But the drug scene there was wicked, 10 times worse than in Arizona. I was trying so hard to be on the straight and narrow. I was talking to God about it all the time. I was like, where's your deep voice now, God, when I really need help? And then I swear I heard it. He told me to split. To where? I asked him. Funny thing about God, though, he don't always give you the answer. Not right when you ask for it. Because I didn't hear nothing. But I knew. I gotta leave. So I went down to the Greyhound station and said, here's how much money I have, give me a ticket. And the boss brought me to Delaware. It's not a paradise, but at least here I can be at peace. It was never like that for me in Nicaragua. And not at my first few stops here neither. I flip burgers now for the king. Used to be at Wendy's, but they gave me, oh man, the worst shifts. So I switched it up. A person needs regular sleep, you know? I ain't getting any younger, but I feel settled here. It took a couple of nasty turns, but I ended up all right.
Alma Rivera from Michoacan soon made friends with many of the neighbors in the apartment complex, who hailed from so many different parts of Latin America. Despite their differences, they became like one big family, showing their support by helping and inspiring each other, as we learn in the story of Nelia Zafón.
I am Boricua, loud and proud, born and raised in Puerto Rico until I told my mommy in 1964, the year I turned 17, that I wanted to live in New York City and dance on Broadway. My mommy put up one hell of a fight.
Ah, you are only 17. You don't have any money. Estás más perdido que el güey Bisco.
All of that. But I had a dream that I was going to be the next Rita Moreno. I was going to be a star. I told my mommy, you can look for me in the movies. And I left. I didn't know a soul when I got to New York. I slept on the floor of Grand Central Terminal for the first 3 nights, watching everyone's feet walk past, men in loafers, women in patent leather heels, click, click, click. Everyone were somewhere to go except for me. I had gotten to my destination and now what? A dream isn't the same thing as a plan. I started feeling like I wanted to return home, but the way I left, all that youthful righteousness and conviction that I threw at my mommy como un tornado, I would have been embarrassed to go back so soon. My mommy would have said,
you see, nena, you're just a little girl after all.
No. I had planted a stake, and now I had something to prove.
to my mommy and to myself, to everyone from my neighborhood. I had to prove that I could make it. I got lucky, though. In the train station, I met a girl, this chica de compañía named Josie, who had gotten kicked out of her parents' house for smoking dope. She had a friend, a guy in Queens, who was going over for the war, and she was going to stay in his apartment until he got back. I'll never forget, she said,
I have to water his plants for him so they don't die.
Later, when he didn't come home, when they couldn't even find enough pieces of his body to put together to send back, she cried so much and for so long that I knew she was in love with him. She had been waiting for him, every day pouring cupfuls of water into the pots that held his plants, turning them in the sunlight, taking care of them because she thought it was a way of taking care of him. I lived in that apartment for 1 year. I'd gotten a job as a waitress, but Josie never charged me rent. Her friend's parents were paying for the apartment, she said. It was covered. Instead, I put all my money towards dance classes and acting classes that I took in the mornings at a little studio in Elmhurst. For food, I ate leftovers off diners' plates at the restaurant. I scraped whatever people didn't eat into cardboard takeout containers and saved it for later. Hash browns, toast crusts, noodles, creamed corn, todo eso. The boss didn't really care. I went to auditions when I heard about them. I remember there was an open call for Man of La Mancha at a small theater in Greenwich Village. I tried out for the role of the housekeeper. When I got there, a man was lining up all the girls. I remember I asked him whether it was okay that I wasn't Spanish, because, of course, it's a Spanish play. He said,
What are you?
Puerto Ricana.
What's the difference?
I didn't get that role. Or any role after that. Not a single one. For years, I tried. After the news of Josie's friend, I had left the apartment in Queens because it didn't feel right for me to stay there. Josie refused to leave. She took over the lease. She kept watering the plants. Maybe it was denial, but maybe it was her only way of holding on to someone she had loved. Maybe we should all be so passionate. Once I was on my own again, I found a place in the cellar under a corner grocery store. Really a cellar. It had damp stone walls and one window, no bigger than a squinted eye. I danced all day and took trains and buses all over the city to auditions. And at night, I carried around trays of food and flirted with the men for bigger tips. On my walk home sometimes, as I stepped back down into that cellar apartment, my eyes heavy from exhaustion, I would think, is this what this is? This country? My life? Is this all? But even when I thought that, I was always aware of some other part of me saying, there is more. And you will find it. I didn't find it, though. I worked like crazy. I practiced dancing until my feet bled and my knees felt like water balloons. I rubbed Vicks into my cracked heels and took so many hot baths, I lost count. I went to a voice coach and sang until my throat was raw. I killed myself. But it never happened for me. The world already had its Rita Moreno, I guess, and there was only room for one Boricua at a time. That's how it works. Americans can handle one person from anywhere. They had Desi Arnaz from Cuba, they had Tintan from Mexico, and Rita Moreno from Puerto Rico. But as soon as there are too many of us, they throw up their hands.
No, no, no. We were only just curious. We are not actually interested in you people.
But I'm a fighter. You get me against the ropes and I will swing so hard. Bam! So I thought, well, if I'm not going to find it, then there's only one other option. I will create it. I researched and found out that taxes for new businesses were lowest in Delaware. So I saved money for a while. I stopped taking classes and signed up for extra shifts at the restaurant and said goodbye to New York. I came to Wilmington to try to start a theater company of my own. I got a job as a waitress again, only at nights, at a bar this time, and during the day I worked on getting the theater going. It was a different time then. The society was different. Free love, fellowship, turn on, tune in, drop out. There were communities of artists, people who didn't want to work for the big corporations, people who were willing to help a girl like me and Many times they worked for free. I met a guy who helped me build sets and put up some lights. I did all the painting myself. I got a whole truck full of wooden pews from a church that was being renovated. I lined them up for the people I dreamed would one day come to watch my shows. The Parish Theater, I called it, because of those pews. In 1971, we had our first production, a play called The Brown Bag Affair. It was very racy, provocative, a lot of nudity, but the story was powerful, and even though for the first few weeks only a few people showed up to see it, word started to spread. First, we had an audience of 10 people, but eventually it grew to 20, everyone sitting shoulder to shoulder in those long pews. Every few months, we did a new show, and 2 years after we opened our doors, we were getting regular crowds for everyone. The theater wasn't making much money, but we were bringing in enough to keep the plays on. That by itself was some kind of miracle. Now, 20 years later, I still run the Parish Theater. We do just one production a week. I act in them sometimes, but the real pleasure for me now is giving roles to other actors, watching them perform, especially the young ones. I was like them once. I can relate. And now I think, okay, this is what it is. My life. This country. It took me so long to get started, and I never became a big star. But now I feel proud when I go back to Puerto Rico to visit my old neighborhood in Caguas because, in a certain way, I did make it, after all. A few months ago, I met a man who came to the theater. He's younger than me, a gringo, an attorney. So young and handsome. Cielos, we have almost nothing in common. But we're a good fit with each other. He makes me laugh. How can I explain it? He has a spirit. I'm 53 years old with wrinkles on my hands. I've never been married in my life, and now this. You never know what life will bring. Dios sabe lo que hace. But that's what makes it so exciting, no? That's what keeps me going. The possibility.
Many of the characters in this small complex are close friends. And one of the closest friendships made is between the two families of the Riveras and the Toros, and their children, Maribel and Mayor. The main characters in The Book of the Unknown Americans by Cristina Enriquez. In this excerpt, we learn just how close they are. Here is Mayor Toro's story.
I started stopping by her apartment sometime after school. Her mom wouldn't let Maribel actually go anywhere with me, so she and I just sat on the floor in the bedroom she shared with her parents and talked. They had clothes folded in piles along the wall and a mattress wedged into the corner. Maribel had a sleeping bag that she rolled up during the day and set under the window. But the atmosphere wasn't inspiring, to say the least. And I found myself wishing that I could take her somewhere, even just to Dunkin' Donuts down the street where I knew we could score free donuts if they were about to throw them away. Or maybe to the movie theaters, where I could show her how to sneak in the side door, which William and I had been doing forever. I thought she deserved it, you know, getting out into the world. As far as I knew, she only went to school and came straight home, which made her seem like a little caged bird who no one trusted to fly. But her mom wouldn't budge. The rule was that if I wanted to see Maribel, it had to be either at her apartment or mine. No going outside, no taking a walk, no nothing. Most of the time, I found her sitting on the bedroom floor, writing in her notebook, or standing and staring out in the back window. I'd ask her what she was looking at or what she was writing about. Sometimes she told me, other times she didn't. Either way, it didn't matter much to me. I was much aware that my original reason for talking to Maribel, which had been fueled by a sense of responsibility, had been replaced by something else. I just wanted to be around her. I still wanted to take care of her in certain ways, but it was more than that now. I liked her. I liked her more than I'd ever liked anyone. We talked about nothing mostly, like what she was doing in school and about music and our parents. I would tell her the most random things. Did you know that the average person drinks 16,000 gallons of water by the time they die? Or by the time I saw Vicente Fox on TV. And she would smile sometimes, which was always my goal. We talked about the weather because now that it was getting colder, she was waiting for it to snow to see what it was like. I guess there's no snow in Mexico, huh? I said. Yes, there's no snow, or yes, there is snow?
There is snow.
In Mexico? No way.
In the north, yes.
You know, there's different kinds of snow, right? There's wet snow, which can get crusty and freezy. And then there's really light snow, which is soft. And don't even get me started on snowflakes. There are four classes of those. Columns, dendrites, needles, and rime snow. She pulled out her notebook.
Say it again?
I did. And she wrote it down. You like that, I asked. She nodded. Can I see? I held out my hand. Without hesitation, she gave me her notebook. On the page that was open, she'd written, wet snow is hard, light snow is soft. Her handwriting was small and tight, and she pushed down so hard with that pen, she made indents on the paper. Everything was centered, one line at a time, down the middle of the page. At the top, way up in the margins, she had written down her name and address. I kept reading.
Close the door behind you. Mrs. Pacer is room 310. My room is 312. How much does the bus ride cost? What is the name of the bus driver? Look at the bus driver's badge. Crystal. The school bus is free. The city bus is not free. This is Newark, Delaware. Delaware is 3,333 kilometers from home. I feel the same today as I did yesterday.
We learn later that Maribel does start improving, and no one is more proud of her than her dad, Arturo Rivera.
I was born in Pátzcuaro, Michoacán, Mexico. I lived there all my life until I came here. Other people from our town had gone north. Most of them left because they wanted a better life. That's what they said, a better life. But it wasn't like that for us. We had a good life, a beautiful life. We lived in a house that I built. We married in the town square where Alma and I were young, when people told us we didn't know anything yet about the world. But we knew. Because the world to us was each other. And then we had Maribel, and our world grew larger. We came here for her. I think about God sometimes, whether he's watching us. Was this what he wanted? Was it all for some greater reason that I don't understand? Were we supposed to come here, to the United States? Is there something better waiting for us here that God, in his infinite vision, can see? Is there something ahead of us that will help all of this make sense finally? I don't know. I don't know all the answers. I don't want to sound ungrateful. We are happy here in many ways. We've met good people. We haven't been here long. But the people in the building where we live have become like a family to us. The teachers at Maribel's school have helped her tremendously. She's getting better, they say. And Alma and I can tell. Maribel has a light in her eyes now. We see that. And nothing, not a single thing, brings us more joy. Maybe it's the instinct of every immigrant, born of necessity or of longing. Someplace else will be better than here. And the condition, if only I can get to that place. It took us a long time to be able to come. We applied and waited to be approved. We traveled for days. We left a lot of things behind. Not only physical objects, but our friends. And, of course, our families. Pieces of ourselves. All for a chance to see that light in Maribel's eyes. It's been difficult, yes, but I would do it all over again. People do what they have to in this life. We try to get from one end of it to the other with dignity and with honor. We do the best we can. I'm overcome when I think about this place and about what it has given us. Maribel is stronger. I can see it every day a little bit more. A safe area to live. Such good friends. It's incredible. One day, when we go back to Mexico and people ask me what it was like here, I will tell them those things. I will tell them all the ways I love this country.
And with that, we close this presentation and encourage everyone to pick up a copy of The Book of the Unknown Americans by Cristina Enriquez and continue to read. Thank you.
That was excerpts from The Book of Unknown Americans by Cristina Enriquez. It's the Multnomah County Library's 2016 Everybody Read Selection, performed by actors from the Milagro Theater. This has been a special edition of Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks by the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this episode or any others in the series, visit literary-arts.org. To hear this episode or any others in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time to find your story here.